Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Guild Podcast, the podcast for the Writers, Artists, and Readers Guild. I am your host, Chris Mary Holtzman. I woke up to tons of snow over here and had to kind of go back into my day job because it was just impossible to work from home because of the internet connections. But anyway, enough of my problems. Today we have a fabulous writer named Rebecca Mickley. And we talk a lot about her ideas behind writing and what writing does on a societal level. It's very, very interesting. And she has a lot to say, a very interesting character to talk to. A lot of ideas, a lot of thoughts. And she was very excited to be on the show. So, without further ado, Rebecca Mickley.
So, at this time, I would like to welcome Rebecca Mickley, author, to the show, to the Guild Podcast. Welcome. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. I'm really excited to be here. Thank you for this opportunity. Looking forward to talking a little bit today.
Yeah, it'll be fun. It's very early where you are. When we were setting this up, I was a little bit taken aback by that you said that you could be up in the AMs. Why are you up so early?
I guess it's just how I'm built. Ever since I've been very, very little, I was that kid that never slept at night. I used to get in trouble at school because I would sleep under my desk during the day, which really annoyed the teachers. You're a teacher, as I understand it, so I guess you'd understand. Yeah. But that habit has persisted, and luckily, because I'm an author and such like that, it just helps me. I get up about 1 o'clock every morning and I go to bed about 5 o'clock in the evening.
It's an interesting, interesting lifestyle choice, I guess. So you kind of be active when other people aren't. And we can jump right into that. You said that you are a writer, and as I understand it, you are a writer by trade. Someplace where we all kind of, a lot of us, who listen to the show and who I've talked to on the show kind of aspire to end up. How did you get so lucky?
Well, honestly, I would have to chalk that up to the gods. I struggled for so many years. I traveled all over the country, all over North America as a truck driver. I've worked in corrections, tech support, psychiatric hospitals. I've done so many things just trying to make ends meet, because my passion was always somewhere else. My passion was always with the written word. About 10 years ago, I met my partner, Alan, and he's a software developer. And he took me to the side and he's like, I want you to find your passion. I don't care how much we struggle, just so long as you find something that makes you happy, we'll find a way to work it out. I want you to work with me and chase a dream. I don't want you to just try to lay down track. I want you to try and chase your dreams. And so it took me a couple of years to really drill down, you know, my focus, where I wanted to go. But one night in 2012, after years of kind of being a hobbyist at short stories and poetry and just poking at it, I started writing Exile's Return. And it just kind of went from there. All of a sudden, things started to fall into place. And it was pretty amazing. But if it wasn't for Alan, I don't know if I could do this full time.
No, that's fun. It's inspiring. I mean, my wife always poked me to do it too, but I think I think she understood that my passion was always writing or creating in one way or another, and she always pushed me to do it. But I think it was all in my own head that I didn't want to. As writers and as creative people overall, you're just like the whole thing of rejection. It's such a big hurdle. It's such a big step, and the idea of being rejected I think is scarier than rejection itself a lot of times.
Oh, absolutely. I kind of see writing in a way as a exercise in humility. You yeah. have to learn not to take yourself so seriously. For me, learning how to take critique was very hard because at first it's very easy to interpret that as a personal attack.
Mm.
And if you want to write honestly, if you really want to refine a work, you have to get beyond where it's personal, and you have to be able to look at it objectively and critically, and that can really be a struggle.
Mm.
And I think that's where a lot of people struggle, honestly, when they're first getting started.
Well, I mean, I think not only when they first get started, I think a lot of people will have stories, because I see being part of a lot of author groups on Facebook and stuff like that, you see a lot of people who've had works accepted and then get in. And I think everybody does get into a period where a lot of things get rejected, and take that as personal attack, and take it as too many. I mean, I see it a little bit like, you know, if you're playing like a role-playing game or a video game and you've got a certain amount of armor, and yes. you just take hits and hits and hits to the armor, and it just weakens it until you have nothing left.
Oh, absolutely. Well, it's very personal, isn't it? I mean, like, well, if your writing is personal, you're pouring your soul into a page. You're pouring something that you believed in and you've thought about and you worked out all of these cool angles and all of this stuff. And then somebody's like, oh, this is just crap. What? Mm. You know, that really hurts.
It does. And I think that the most important part, and what, like you said, lesson in humility, I think what you have to take from that is that, you know, I think you got to take a step back and look at, you know, what am I doing here? What am I doing wrong? I've noticed that when I write stuff, both things that have been rejected and even stuff that has been accepted, I'm just like, is there a risk that I'm repeating myself here? Is there a risk that this is basically the same story, or the same thing is happening to this character that happened to an earlier character in a different story? And I think a lot of times when people do get rejected is maybe that it's not as original as one thought. And it's just like, hey, you know, I've heard you tell this story before.
Yes. Well, there is that, I guess it's kind of a meme that there's only so many different kinds of stories that actually exist as kind of a meta concept in our mm-hmm. culture. You know, we've got the hero's journey and the fall from grace and all of these larger meta concepts, and everything is supposedly a variation on these core themes, but you know, it's all about how you tell it, right? Mm. So,
and I think also
about taking a fresh spin on it.
Yeah. I also think it happens. It's like who it's happening to, like which character is being subjected to this idea or this torture sometimes that the author puts them through, these hurdles.
Yeah. I have a cup that was given to me by one of my editors, and on the front, it's a white coffee cup. And in black writing and very big bold letters, it says "Tears of My Readers" that wraps around it. And that's kind of become a theme, because in order for writing to be impactful, sometimes you have to go there. Sometimes you have to mm-hmm. take risks. Sometimes you have to really step out with those characters. And there are going to be people in your audience that are not going to be happy with you.
No.
And you will hear about it.
I teach a creative writing class at the school where I work. That's what I try to tell my students. You get a lot of students that want to be writers and want to write, and I tell them, you know, the same thing that my creative writing teacher told me, that you need to, it's important that you take it that extra step. You know, don't be afraid to make it a little gritty, a little dirty, a little sad, a little sexy, you know, wherever it's going, just don't stop there. I think that's where you risk ending up in like these older young adult fiction books where they don't really take it all the way. And I think that's what the new concept of young adult oftentimes is, that you actually have, I think that's why they get banned. You have like sex scenes yeah. in young adult between teenagers, which the schools don't like.
We're kind of on the vanguard as writers of pushing the envelope and doing all of the self-examination and the soul searching and what it means to be and what it means to feel and what it means to encounter and experience. We explore those frontiers with the narratives we create. And I think that's especially true in speculative fiction and fantasy. And like you said, YA, young adult, all of that. There are all of these different journeys of becoming and exploration and both internal and external discoveries. And so to kind of really drill down in that, you have to be afraid. You have to be unafraid to step out there, you know, as Gene Roddenberry would say, to boldly go, or as I like to say, onward towards the farthest star.
So true. And that's what I learned when I studied literature at the university. My mentor, one of my like real, the one who inspired me a lot in becoming creative, which is odd for somebody when you study literature to become creative, because sometimes that kills your creativity. He always said that genre fiction, just like you said, with speculative fiction and fantasy, is always more important for people to read than general fiction, because you're never going to learn anything from reading Jane Austen. Really, because it says nothing, says very little about its time. It's like a history book. It basically just kind of, you can read a story like the one about Elizabeth Bennet and Mr. Darcy. And I'm probably a lot of people that listen to this are going to be like really upset, but you can read that in any history book because it all it does is basically touch the surface.
Yes.
Whereas like the genre fiction, the stuff that people really wanted to read was the stuff that, you know, pushed the envelope. Talked about desires and the filling the hole in people's, you know, inside.
Yes. Well, you know, and it's interesting that you say that because I'm going to kind of, I guess, turn this on the whole format here on its head a little bit. But one of the things I've always liked about Victor Hugo's writings, who, as you know, was like a French contemporary during a very revolutionary time, you know, 1830s, 1840s, and going up through that. I have found when I, especially when I was younger, like when I was in high school and college, you know, The Hunchback of Notre Dame to this day is one of my favorite stories. Mm-hmm. I think Les Miserables is also very impactful because he went a little bit beyond what we see in a lot of what we call like general fiction literature. Yeah. There was connection and development with Quasimodo and Esmeralda and all of that. And so I think you kind of sometimes find your lessons where you can connect.
Mm.
And so I think that's the appeal with speculative fiction and genre-based fiction. Like you were saying, it's about connecting with people where they're at and where they're passionate or where they're curious. And then it's taking that like kindling and building a greater fire.
Yeah. Well, tell us a little bit about your writer's journey. I've said several times on this podcast that for writers and other creative people as well, probably, I'm not that kind of creative. I don't paint. I don't do any, those kind of things. But that it's all like it's a kinetic energy inside that we want to get out. And to me, it's always been like, if you don't get that creativity out somehow, you can kind of damage yourself and damage others by creating fiction, you know, in your life. I mean, my wife can tell if I haven't been writing, because I'll say the most absurd things, or, you know, she'll say something and then I'll just take it and kind of run with it and make it into something and it's not.
Yes.
So did you have that fire inside you all the time? You kind of hinted at it in the beginning.
I love my quotes and my sayings and my truisms and all of this. I love distillations of wisdom. And one of my favorite sayings about writing is attributed to Mark Twain. A writer is a story trapped in a person. You know, that there is this need and this drive that seems innate in creatives to express, and it's going to come out one way or another, like you said, you know. And so I will be sitting sometimes, I'll be talking with Alan or, you know, some of the other people that I live with here in the house, and all of a sudden I'm just getting poetic and I'm knocking off, you know, this narrative, and I'm just ranting, you know, as they say, I rant, I ramble. Kind of like now, I guess. And you just, there's just this drive to go. And that's why the blank page can be intimidating, but it's such a relief in a way. It's an outlet for all of that energy.
So it's a bright blue flame somehow inside.
Absolutely. It's all consuming, and it has to be fed, and it has to be shown. You can't just hide it away. It's going to find a way to burn through whatever you drop on top of it, one way or another.
Yeah, it's true. So true. And fed too. I guess I haven't thought about it that way because, I mean, I have, and I think that annoys my wife at times too, is that I'll be so kind of like attentive and listen to and pay attention to what people are doing around me that I don't know. Like if we're out, you know, in the store, or if I'm, you know, watching somebody, you know, at a restaurant, and just like, I wonder what that story is. What are they talking about? What is that story? And that is kind of like the feeding. You take that and you think about that. That's a situation that I can use later, build upon.
Do you ever like sit in public? Because this is something I found I do, and I'll watch two people interacting, or I'll watch a group that's dressed a little differently, you know, roam by, and I'll start spinning in my own head, just like, oh, they're doing this and they're off to do that. And sometimes I try to get really absurd with it, you know, especially you see this, you know, sports team meandering through, and they've got, you know, these sports fans with all their headgear and stuff. I'm like, oh, so the Zovarans have sent another delegation today, I see, you know.
Yeah, it definitely happens. And then it's exciting. You end up living in your own, definitely in your own world.
Absolutely. To be a writer is to live in your own head. I am convinced of that. I only visit out here, you know.
So when you said that you wrote short stories, you dabbled in short stories, and then you kind of sat down to work on your own, your big work. I mean, how did that happen? Where did you get your inspiration for it?
My primary mentor as a writer, and I had the great fortune, I have had the great fortune of meeting and forging a friendship with this individual, is a writer that's not as known in popular circles, but his name is Phil Goyce. Mm-hmm. And I met him in the early 90s, and well, the late 90s, excuse me, I'm not that old yet. And his work really inspired me with how much it just was connected and how personal, how deep. And I was able to meet him, and we started talking, and he started to teach me a little bit about writing, but the foundations were already there. I can remember being 8-9 years old and writing a poem every morning when I woke up, and then I would share it with my family. I had that phase for a while. There was always something in me that wanted to express, but it was a very raw kind of untempered fire. And there was this very unintentional, but now that I look back on it, you know, trajectory that all coalesced and condensed down to me writing my novels. You know, I've had mentors, I've had people I've connected to, stories that have inspired me, and a drive to do this. But the direction didn't really start to come until about 10 years ago, where I really started to understand what to do with it.
Mm-hmm. That's, I mean, it's interesting because that's kind of coincides a little bit with the when like the self-publishing became like exploded a little bit more with, you know, the opportunity that obviously Amazon has afforded everybody, publishing their work, and then obviously other. I know that Barnes and Noble, you can self-publish through Barnes and Noble, but I don't think it's as common that people do that.
I don't think so either, and it's not something that I've looked into personally. I had a very interesting journey. I was traditionally published originally in 2014. Exile's Return was my very first novel. And it was traditionally published in 2014 to a very small and independent press. And it was very important to me that I get that check. You know, I submitted, I went out, and then, you know, all of a sudden, you know, Legion is like, we want to publish. And I'm like, whoa, you know, it just, that was absolutely mind blowing. And then it happened. you know, we went through the edits and we got ready and we launched and then it happened and ... crickets. I mean, just flatline right out of the gate. And it was very distressing. And I have no bitterness at all towards Legion. But what I learned was, is that just because you get a publishing contract does not mean that's going to be the best fit for you. That was the lesson. And so in 2017, as my contract was getting ready to expire, I approached them. I said, guys, this isn't working out for me. I want to try to take this in a new direction. I want to go independent. And they went, okay, we're sorry. Here's your rights back. We'll let you out of your contract early. And so they let me out of my contract a year early. And I took all the stuff I've been working on. I had Dawnbreak, Rise, Farthest Star, and some of these haven't even been published yet, but I have all of these in the can and waiting in the wings. And Dawnbreak was the prequel to Exile's Return.
Okay.
I was so proud of it. I thought it was one of the greatest things I had written to date, which, you know, and I got it. I paid to get it edited. I put it out on Amazon and it just started going. I repackaged everything, starting with Dawnbreak as novel one, and we went forward. And that's where I started to find at least a modicum of success. And I started to build from there. But that was a real leap of faith for me to do that. That really scared me at the time to take that step.
What do you think was the difference between going through Legion? Because it sounds to me like Legion didn't maybe didn't have the marketing going on. Because, I mean, I have some experience with publishing and independent presses, not so much with self-publishing, but mostly with independent presses and stuff like that. And the big difference, I mean, they'll all be able to do the work that you can do when you self-publish, basically, you know, the editing. They can do it either if they have it in-house or if they pay for it. And they can do the formatting and they can make you a cover. But the thing that they can do that you might not be able to do is the marketing. And was that the big difference for you, or was there a difference, another difference?
That the marketing was the primary difference. I wanted to get a traditional publisher, number one, because I wanted that kudo. It was a goal for me to check that box. It to me was very validating that I had arrived as an author that some business somewhere looked at my work and went, okay, yeah, I think this would be something that would appeal to people. That really meant something to me at the time. And very much at the time, I feel like I've grown beyond that. And the primary reason, but beyond that, was I wanted somebody to help me with the marketing and the publishing. Because as gregarious as I come across, I can be very introverted and I don't understand social media that well. And it costs a lot of money to advertise on sites and to get out to conventions. And I was really looking for partnership there, but I didn't understand about the industry that when you are working with any type of publisher, it's not you and that publisher, it's you and that publisher and however other many authors that they've got under contract, and there's only so much that can go around. And so when my work was not an immediate catch right out of the gate, even though I feel that Exile is a very decent work and I feel Dawnbreak is good work and I do think I'm a decent writer, I would like to hope at least that I am, my stuff got de-emphasized, you know, because this is a business, right? With self-publishing, as hard as the marketing and the publishing and the expense, which is one of the reasons why it slowed down my releases, it costs a lot to put out a work. I suddenly was in control of all of it, and I have the passion for my work. It's not just a marketing opportunity to me. It's not just about making money. In fact, as much as I would love to be more profitable with my work, I would say making money is a lesser priority for me. I want to be read. I want to get out there. I want people to see this because I've got this story and I need to share it.
Yeah, and I think that's another part of the whole thing that you have to tell you have to tell students or people who want to be writers that it's so important that your work gets read, that has to be the primary focus. Mm-hmm. There's also that the story, because the publisher that I went through for my debut novel, his mantra was kind of like, we don't want to poke too much in your work, you know. Mm-hmm. We don't want to change it around too much, because that was his experience when he was a writer, that he had the publishing company that he first went through wanted to change too much of the story.
Absolutely.
But I think there's a happy medium there. There can be like, you know what, this and this would maybe work a little bit better if you did this, and the pacing could be a little quicker here, or maybe kind of drop this character in here or drop him in later, or things like that. So there needs to be a happy medium when you work with a publisher. And I think when you do that, if you have a publisher that kind of is involved in your work like that and says like, you know, change this, kind of maybe tweak this a little bit, or you know, maybe this could be two characters, or this could be one character instead of two, then I think the editor or the publisher has a greater stake in the book and more
that's
pride.
An excellent point.
And bigger pride in the work too, because they've been part of the development, instead of just like, hey, here's a script, manuscript, we'll format it for you, we'll edit it so it looks grammatically correct, but I'm not going to really kind of engage in it. And I think also in a way, that's why the big publishing houses, they just take a script and they create the blurb and they create the cover. And in doing so, they have to read the story line by line and engage in it.
Mm-hmm. You have to give them a reason to feel invested, basically. Mm-hmm. You know, when somebody adds anything to a work, all of a sudden they have a connection to it. Every time they read that one sentence that they suggested that you decided to put in, that's my sentence. Yeah, I've seen stuff like that. You know, I have a wonderful editor by the name of Kat Luck that she works with me, and Maya and Alex. And every day I go through and I do my writing, and then I'll kick it off to them, and then we'll fight about it. Is what I say. We'll discuss it. You know, this part, I don't really like this part. I think you're completely out of your head here. And sometimes, you know, we get a little passionate, but in that debate, in that exchange, the work becomes stronger. Every day I sit down with Alan and I do the same thing. And through all of this, I kind of call it, you know, editing by committee or expanding by committee. And it creates a greater work for me, and it keeps me fresh about taking and receiving criticism and not taking it personally and all that. It's great work.
And I think it's good because you become a better writer. I've been involved in a couple of different kind of like shared world projects. You call them 13 projects, where 13 authors write a chapter each of the same story. And they're all interconnected, and the point is that the stories are supposed to, like, characters are supposed to return in the various chapters, or they're supposed to be like, you know, things happen parallel. There's a couple of different ways you can do it. There's some where each story is very, very individual. It just takes place in the same spot in the same area, and those maybe aren't as fun. I've also been part of a 13 project where people just wrote, you know, you have one that wrote 13 authors each wrote 13 pages, and each chapter was 13 pages, and then you just were supposed to like continue the story afterwards.
Oh wow.
And that was interesting, but I noticed that because I came in writing chapter 2, and I felt that I put a lot of setup in for expanding the story, a lot of characters that were introduced in my chapter. And I just felt that people didn't hook on to them at all, which made it less of my story. It felt like my chapter became kind of like an anomaly in a chapter.
And that always hurts. You know, you write something, you're like, I love this. This is going to connect. And I don't know what you're doing here. What? Come on. You know, come on.
And now those characters are like, they tied up in that story. So it's not like I can write my own story with those characters in, because they're already used up.
So there went that idea, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But talk a little bit about your books. What are they about? What can people expect when they're reading Dawnbreaker and so on?
Well, the first thing I would tell people to expect with my work is to expect the unexpected. I like to break rules. I like to chase tropes and break tropes. And I don't do this necessarily to be edgy. I try to approach my writing the way that one would approach a living history. I try to write not from the ideas like, I am going to write a science fiction story about X in space. I've tried to think about and conceive of a world. Mm-hmm. I create a world, this huge open world. When I started a universe, I often create what they call like a Bible. You know, mm-hmm. This is the kind of technology. This is how it works. This is what's been going on. These are the politics. These are the factions. And then I start thinking of a character, or a character often pops up out of all of this, you know, as I'm looking at all of these details and building all of the stuff in. And then I kind of throw them into the world and let the simulation run. And I just try to document what I see. I kind of try to take a step back. And so like with things with a lot of my work narrative is focused on individuality, self-acceptance, growth, challenge, society's response to that. Primarily, I am what they call a xenofiction specialist, which is a writer that writes from non-human perspectives as a way to make commentary on or observations of human nature. Mm-hmm. And all of that works out with science fiction and fantasy and speculative fiction and all that fun stuff. Kind of a big ramble here.
But... No. So what is, I mean, so if you just choose like your latest work or your favorite piece of fiction, what would you say for somebody who would be interested in reading it? What does it deal with? What is it about? And I mean, what does it deal with? What commentary does it make? And in what way does it do it?
Well, let's start with Dawnbreak, because that's the one that I most often promote, because it's book one in my Farthest Star universe, which I consider my flagship universe. It's a near future sci-fi. It's set, the universe begins in about 2070, 40 years after a limited nuclear exchange across the world caused the collapse of the major superpowers and the governments. And the world had to kind of come back together, and they started to rebuild out of those ashes. And the one thing that really unified the world was the discovery of the compact fusion drive. They figured out how to make a fusion drive and make it compact enough that they could put it on a ship or use it to power a city, something like that. Mm-hmm. They created a probe called the Far Horizons Project in 2031. They sent it out to go interstellar. You know, it was the first, because with the fusion drive and space being largely frictionless, they could get what they called up to near light speeds. So like 0.2, 0.3 mm-hmm. of the speed of light without getting too much into what, you know, relativistic distortion. The probe crosses into interstellar space, and then it registers an external detonation and goes silent. And the humans freak, you know, it looks like this thing was attacked. We finally took the first steps out of our solar system. We were able to get it, you know, out in just a little over a few months, because space is really freaking big. But that was absolutely revolutionary. And so the whole world started to bootstrap under this idea of, oh my God, there could be an invasion coming. You know, they're going to wipe us out. You know, humanity started looking beyond. And so they founded this unified Earth government, and they started bootstrapping up from shuttles. And then about 20 years later, we see the launch of the first human starships. And they start just with very primitive technology. The ships have to spin to generate gravity and stuff. They start just pushing out and going out on these longer and longer patrols, 6 month patrols, year patrols, 2 year patrols, just trying to, you know, see what's out there, see what's coming. And then one day, out of nowhere, this ship appears in front of an Earth ship called the Danube, and they lose all power, and their motion just stops in the middle of space, and they are completely adrift and completely at this craft's mercy. And then their speakers pop and it says, "We mean you no harm. We come in peace. We want to negotiate." And the humans freak, right? Because this does not seem peaceful, right? You know, you don't just show up, shut down a ship, take over the ship, and then go, "Hi, want to be friends?" But that's exactly what they did. And they present this fact that we have a gate network. We'll open up the galaxy to you. We've got some worlds that you could colonize. All of this great stuff. We'll give this to you. No problem. We want your cultural archives. We want to know your history. We want to know about your language and your world. Oh, but there is this one thing. There is this one thing that we want in exchange for all this, but it's just minor. No big deal. We have this concept, this religion called the Path of the Other. And if you want our gate network, if you want access to the galaxy through us, you have to make this available to your people. Okay, well, what's that? Well, we live so many hundreds of years as ourselves, and then our people like to take up other identities. We like to shift to other species. We like to take up different forms to explore what that means. And this is how we grow and evolve as a people. And we want you to take this technological religion we have and share it with your people and see what happens. And Dawnbreak opens after these events have largely concluded. And the first people to take up the Path of the Other are starting to come into society, and actually follows the journey of two of those people, Joyce and John, as they are the first people to kind of embrace this path.
It's quite a large concept, and seems like you've there's a lot of work behind.
Oh, absolutely. Like I said, that was a big, deep ramble. I really got into it there. I mean, it's like, you want backstory? I will give you backstory. And I'm sorry that was so long. I suspect there might be editing in the future. But
no, actually, I try to edit as little as possible in this. Because I want people's message to be conveyed, obviously. But so where did you, you know, when it comes to inspiration, where did you take your inspiration for such a large concept? I mean, what kind of writers and did you look at for inspiration for something so grand?
Like I said, Phil Goyce is a huge inspiration to me. Robert Heinlein is a huge inspiration to me, even though he's more controversial now because he is a very problematic writer, especially for modern times. He was very misogynistic. He had a lot of issues with gender roles and alternative lifestyles, and his language can be very, let us say, colloquial and old in some ways. But the thing that absolutely amazed me about Heinlein, and which really forces me to look beyond it, and I have a lot of friends of mine that I deeply respect that cannot stand the man, and I do not begrudge them that at all, is that he was able to make these amazing characters and these expansive, to me, just near inconceivable worlds and make them so real and so accessible. Stranger in a Strange Land, the tale of Valentine Michael Smith, as you know, the first human that was raised by Martians, and then he comes back to Earth and he has to learn what it means to be a person and what it means to fit into society and what it means to laugh and to cry and to connect and to feel like a person, and how unnecessary all of the stuff that we let wear us down are, the hatred and division and the ugliness. One of my favorite parts of that entire novel, and I think it's one of the things that has inspired me the most, is where Valentine Michael Smith has finally learned why people laugh. And he says, "Laughter is when it hurts and there's nothing you can do about it." And then he says right after that, "And you realize this is all fundamentally unnecessary, right? All of the anger, all of the pain, all of the hurt, we can fix it." And that just lit me on fire. And the way that they fixed it, it wasn't through any kind of mean or military way. It was by the learning of language, the expanding of concepts, and the seizing of individuality. And that greatly inspired me, especially with The Path of the Other. The ultimate question of Dawnbreak is that what makes us different enough to save us all? Mm-hmm. It is only through the embracing of individual and unique perspectives that we kind of become this choir of different lights that illuminates the world around us in new and amazing ways that leads to new and interesting discoveries. Monocultures don't evolve because they're never challenged. But in a society of individuals where everyone is competing and sharing, but also accepting, there is this constant exchange and evolution. It's like a reactor. It's like a crucible. And I think there's something so valuable about that. And I think there's something so powerful about that. And I express that through my morphics, you know, these people that are born and they don't necessarily identify as humans. The humans take the path of the other in a way that the Mendeans, these aliens, never intended, because they do it just to adopt other perspectives. But there are these humans, they're like, well, I've never really felt like a human. I've never really felt like a guy or a girl and all of that. So why don't I try a new species? Why don't I try to become something else for a while? Wonder what that's like. Or for some people like Joyce and John, especially, they have a deep connection, this deep spiritual connection that they might not fully understand, where they feel almost called to be something other than human. And
interesting concepts.
Absolutely. And in boldness, Joyce seizes that in Dawnbreak, and she starts trying to live that dream and trying to realize that, but she doesn't live in a vacuum. She's surrounded by a world and a society that might fight that threatening or concerning or weird or freakish. And she's going to have to live with that as she changes and as she becomes. And that's going to say something about her, and that's going to say something about the world, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And I think it's an interesting concept that actually is quite, you know, it's very apropos right now when the world is becoming more acceptable of people being, you know, born in the wrong body and stuff like that. And it's really only once society allows, or society gives those possibilities, you know, that you can change, you know, your gender or sexual, you know, your sex or whatever, that people start realizing that they need to, or they were never born in the right body. And very, very interesting. And I think a lot of people enjoy that kind of like philosophical aspect of the book. And our time is unfortunately winding down. What are you working on right now? What do you have in the future?
Well, I have written all in told 19 novel manuscripts to this date. I've released 5. I've created multiple story universes. But the next thing that I'm hoping to release, as I'm able to gather the funding for it, is Farthest Star, which is the continuation of my Farthest Star universe. It's the eponymous novel, you know. This is where some things are going to get resolved. You know, this is the big one, you know, Farthest Star. And as that story progresses. But right now, what I'm writing is Angels of Our Yesterday, which is much farther down in the series. I write these in order. And I'm just continuing to explore the growth of the morphic movement and the consequences and the fallout and the new government and what's going on and now the greater galaxy as a whole, as the humans and the morphics have become part of it. And the story has just continued to evolve. Right now we are in book 10. I'm writing, I think this is book 10 of the Farthest Star universe. And we've only got 3 out so far. So that's a lot to look forward to if you guys are hooked.
Well, at least you have that many books, you know, ready to go. And, you know, people aren't going to be waiting too long maybe for to see the.
It's mainly as I can get the funding to get them professionally edited and then out, because that is a large expense, especially as an independent. But I have the most wonderful and the most patient fans in the world, I think, because they also understand, you know, what it means. I was talking earlier about how, you know, my husband is a software developer and all of this other stuff, but it really is a struggle. We really have had to agree as a couple to make a sacrifice for me to pursue this. And I will always be grateful to him for his selflessness, but also there is no way I think I could not do this. This was going to happen one way or another, even if I was living in a box writing these works. And I thank the gods that I have the opportunities and the privileges that I've had, as hard as it is sometimes.
Mm. I understand that, definitely. If people want to connect with you, where can they find you on the internet and social media and stuff like that?
Well, I've been very active as of late on Twitter under the handle Trailhair, because I am also a long distance hiker and blogger for the trek. I am about to set out on the Pacific Crest Trail in April, which is a 4,600 kilometer journey, 2,650 miles. And I'll be blogging there at thetrek.co. There's also Snowy Trails on Instagram and Rebecca Mickley on Facebook. So I am out there. Come by, say hello, hang out with me. If you don't like me, tell me I'm terrible. We'll work on it. You know, and we'll see what happens. I'm always happy to meet and talk with people. Come challenge me, you know, come meet me, come inspire me. Let's chat.
That's very good. It's a very healthy attitude to have in this world. And I think that's also, when I talked to Jacob Sanix last week about this, when I started out, I found that the fantasy community was quite closed. But I think I was connecting to it with the wrong fantasy authors. The horror authors were a lot more open. As of late, there's more and more fantasy authors that are willing to be there and help each other and support. But I think it has to do, I had the discussion with somebody else. Can't remember who it was we were talking about, like maybe people, fantasy authors are a little bit scared of like the bleed, the world building bleed into, because you're already always in the shadow of Tolkien or Lewis. And I think that so you don't want to, you're afraid of that bleed, that inspiration, stealing somebody else's concepts when you're already kind of stealing Tolkien's concepts for the most part. People who use trolls and orcs and elves and stuff like that.
Well, I'm going to go right back to good old Mark Twain again. I am a writer and therefore I am a suspicious person. That is another quote attributed to Twain. But we all borrow and we all inspire each other. And I find it unfortunate when I find writing communities that are closed and so afraid about all of that, because Tolkien didn't invent trolls and elves and orcs whole cloth. He pulled a lot of that from Saxon and Anglo-Saxon belief and mythology. And as someone that is a Saxon heathen, every time he refers to Middle Earth, I kind of perk up, because Middle Earth is the way that Saxons and Anglo-Saxons referred to the Norse Midgard.
Mm-hmm.
That's what Midgard means, is Middle Earth, Middle World. It's in the middle of the Nine. And so Tolkien borrowed from myth and legend and fairy tale. And now people get inspired from Tolkien writing, and the generations of writing are an actual evolution and distillation of thought and an expansion of that thought. And I think that's why we must write boldly and being inspired by the giants that came before us, so that we aren't competing with them, but we're standing on their shoulders and we're pushing that art forward. You know, there was always this idea, this dichotomy of opened or closed. And I would much rather be open. I'd much rather see what's out there.
Mm. Yeah, I agree. And on that note, I would like to thank you for coming on. It's been a lovely time, and I'm sure that there's so much more we could talk about, and I hope that you have you come on again in the future.
I would love it. Thank you so much for being tolerant of my rambling. I know I can get going, you know, it's like bunny go, but you know, here we are.
Yeah, no, it was a delight, and I've had worse rants, so don't you worry.
I'll take that. I've had worse. I can take that. That'll work.
that was the end of that. Very interesting. We could have talked for hours, I am sure. A lot of interesting aspects, a lot of interesting discussions and thoughts and stuff like that. So be sure to pick up a copy of Rebecca Mickley's books for support, if nothing else. I would like to thank Rebecca Mickley for coming on. I'd like to thank you all for listening. I'd like to thank John Holtman, who provided the music. Please follow us on Instagram, on Twitter, and on Facebook. Keep up to date with what we're doing. Stay warm out there if you have as much snow as we do here where I am. Cheers. See you next time.